Good evening and welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Deborah Becker. Tonight, the third in our series of two-hour special programs from the international conference, Global Health, A Bridge to the Future. Recently, a small group of global leaders in health and development met at Boston University to consider the future of health. The conference approached the topic from four thematic areas: creativity, identity, urbanization, and institutions. Tonight, we hear excerpts from Session 4, titled Urbanization. We begin with an introduction by moderator Jonathan Simon, director of the Center for International Health and Development at the Boston University School of Public Health.
I'm quite looking forward to this session because it allows us to bring three very different thinkers to set off our discussion a bit on some of the challenges we face in trying to think through what's the role of urban issues as we think about health and development. And I would stress the importance of the development piece of that. And I'm going to argue that today's session actually changes a bit the presentations, because we go from the unknown. What is health? Or what is an identity? Or is there a global citizenship, a global identity, to some things which are much more concrete? And I would argue that the future in some ways regarding cities is well known. And our first speaker, Mark Montgomery, he's the numbers guy. For those of us who follow the challenges of cities, the person we turn to try and get our sense of where the projections are, it really is Mark's work, and I think we're fortunate to have him. He's a senior associate at the Population Council and a professor of economics at SUNY in New York, and he has really led a lot of the scholarship around trying to think about the transformation of cities moving forward. So as a first speaker, Mark will have an opportunity to talk about what is the future known, not the future unknown, but if we look to 2050, we have some pretty good sense because of the embedded dynamics of what actually is going to be going on. He's quite interested in poverty. He's quite interested in governance issues. So he gives us not only a numbers perspective, but he also leads us to that discussion of development. Our second presenter, is Farouk Albaz. He's a research professor here at Boston University and is the director of the Center for Remote Sensing at Boston University. And for those of us as young children who are so excited by the moon landings, I realized that Farouk picked the spot. So when the moon landings were occurring, it was based largely on the science, the scholarship, the thoughtfulness, and the absolute creativity that Farouk has brought to his professional career. The third speaker is Bert Singer from Princeton. And I think any of us working in public health know that we have tremendous complexity to deal with. And in order to deal with complexity, we believe you need interdisciplinary science and interdisciplinary approaches. And it's easy to talk that game. And Professor Singer is one of the extraordinary members of the global public health community who is truly walking the walk. He's a demographer. He's had professional academic appointments in demography, public affairs. He's chaired an epidemiology department. He holds a professorship in economics and a professorship in statistics. Now, I believe you form interdisciplinary groups by actually having six or seven people do this. Bert has decided to form an interdisciplinary group within himself, and it provides a tremendous opportunity to synthesize a large set of information and knowledge into what, as I read his scholarship and have heard him speak previous times, is a very, very interesting speaker and an interesting contributor to global thinking on this issue. Bert has also reminded us that malaria is not a rural disease, that in fact urban malaria is in resurgence, and a lot of that has to do with how we are constructing our urban environment. Thank you very much, Mark. Would you kick us off?
This will give you a sense of the direction in which our discussion is headed. I will be talking about urbanization in the developing world and its implications for health. I'll begin, as John mentioned, with a review of the numbers. These are not quantities known with certainty, but they are quantities that are reasonably well known, having to do with the evolution of the urban population of the developing world, over the next 30 to 40 years. We'll then take a closer look at some of the implications for health. As the developing world continues to urbanize, we can expect that urban issues will take on increasing prominence in discussions of health and poverty. As that discussion takes place, it will be quite important to look beneath the urban averages and to take seriously issues associated with urban inequalities in health. Then I'll conclude with some thoughts on the targeting of health resources. Despite what you may have read or heard, the era of world population growth is far from being at an end. If you look out 30 years or so, as the UN does in its forecasts, it's anticipated that we will add about 2 billion persons to the world's total. What is different about what lies ahead is the composition of that growth. In the past, let's say from 1950 to 1975, much of the growth was taking place more or less equally in the rural and urban areas of the developing world. But as we look ahead to 2030, of the roughly 2.1 billion persons to be added to the world's total, nearly 2 billion are expected to reside in the towns and the cities of the developing world. So increasingly prominent on the urban scene in developing countries will be these large cities. And as we think about the implications for development and the implications for health, clearly we need to be thinking about this aspect of scale and the benefits and costs that scale brings. So as we envision this urban future, it's easy, I think, for us to think of the very large cities as somehow dominating the urban scene. We think of, you know, Lagos or Sao Paulo, Mexico City, Karachi. We need to be careful in taking that step, because most of the city growth that's anticipated to take place will take place not in the largest cities, the so-called mega cities of 10 million or more, or cities near that size, but rather in relatively small urban agglomerations of under 1 million in size. And as we look at how the distribution of population by city size will evolve over the coming years, we see then in poor countries, just as in rich countries, the bulk of urban residents reside in cities under 1 million in size. About 60% is the UN's forecast for poor countries. So it's all too easy, I would say, for us to envision an urban future that is dominated in a numerical sense by the largest cities. We cannot lose sight of the fact that it's the smaller cities where the bulk of the urban population will be housed. These cities generally are less well served in terms of water, sanitation, electricity, educational resources, and so on. They face challenges in terms of public health, in terms of the professional expertise that's been brought to bear on such cities. Increasingly, as developing countries decentralize their systems of government and place cities and regions in decentralized systems, the position of these smaller cities will need to be taken carefully into account. The resources available to them, the transfers from other levels of government that they need, and so forth. You would think that these broad trends, these broad demographic features, which are reasonably well known, would have been factored into current thinking about economic development, would have shaped theories and strategies regarding poverty alleviation. And, well, there has been some recognition of the urban future, but it's surprisingly limited. Much of the attention given to health and poverty in the developing world in relation to its urban future has to do with the numbers and anticipated growth of the slum-dwelling population. It wasn't long ago that estimates of the numbers of slum dwellers were, you know, very much impressionistic and not scientifically grounded. UN Habitat has made great strides, I think, in the last decade in firming up the scientific foundation for its estimates. There is, as I say, limited recognition of the urban poor in the Millennium Development Goals. There is only one urban-specific development goal that is articulated in this set. It is to achieve by 2020 significant improvement in the lives of at least 100 million slum dwellers. And so this is a rather modest goal even by current standards. And if you factor in the anticipated growth of urban populations and thus the growth of slum populations, the goal is even more modest than it may first appear. A good bit of work has established that, yes, on average, urban residents do tend to enjoy better levels of health than rural villagers. HIV/AIDS is the rather grim exception to that generalization. But as you look beneath those averages in urban areas, there is substantial socioeconomic inequality evident. The urban poor often face risks to health that are much like those one sees in rural areas. They are as poorly equipped with knowledge about prevention and treatment, often, as rural villagers. And although it's often glibly assumed that urban residents being within sight of hospitals and so forth, they must surely, it's often assumed, have access to these resources, that simply is not the case on closer study. Issues of access to modern healthcare resources indicate that the urban poor often face substantial difficulty in gaining access. And among the urban poor, those who are spatially concentrated, that is, who live in slums, communities of deprivation, can face health risks that are well in excess of those seen in rural areas. So I've been building a case here for thinking more seriously about urban poverty and particularly the health disadvantages suffered by slum residents. And that does seem to me to be the way to move forward, that we do think more seriously about these inequalities. As we move forward, we need to be careful about equating urban poverty with slum dwelling. Right? We do not know at the moment what proportion of the urban poor live in slums. Right? We do not know what proportion of slum residents are poor. We know from our own experience that slums are heterogeneous communities, and some more so than others. If we were to form a scientific basis for the targeting of health resources, we need answers to these basic questions. Simple analyses looking at the neighbors of the urban poor would indicate that there is more heterogeneity in the neighborhoods of the urban poor than we are often led to believe by the opening paragraphs of journal articles on urban poverty and health. Right? There is reason to be skeptical about the portrayal of slums as uniformly poor and of the poor as being entirely concentrated in slums. Right. To conclude then, if we were to move forward to make progress in addressing urban poverty and its implications for health, we should do so with some concerns about slum definitions and the implications for the targeting of health resources. We need to take more seriously as we go forward both the disadvantages and potential advantages of slum heterogeneity and the extent to which heterogeneity may, in fact, help to sustain health programs in those communities. Even within slums, I haven't shown you the evidence, but there is good evidence that even within slums, differences in household levels of living can make a difference to the levels of health. What we need going forward is research attention to what has been called the social epidemiology of health. In the Boston area, I think I must be preaching to the converted here, there's been a great deal of work in here at BU and Harvard and other places on the concept of social epidemiology. It's time, I would say, to bring that concept to bear on the urban populations of poor countries. And there's much to be learned and much to be gained in terms of program design and the targeting of resources there. So I'll leave it there. Thank you.
Welcome to this urban session. I come originally from Egypt, and Cairo used to be the main problem as far as urban problems are concerned. But right now there are at least 20 urban communities, 10 in the Nile Delta and 10 for the rest of Egypt, that could be called problems, cities with urban problems. All of them are a lot more than a million each. So this becomes not just a one problem of the capital of the place, but a problem for the whole country. And I am personally a geologist, and I am interested in the physical plant of human populations or human occupation sites, both today and yesterday, because we also delve into a little bit in archaeology and what human populations in the past were like. So it would be looking at the physical plant of these the main city or the main cities, and how one can approach thinking about that physical plant and what could be done about their future as far as both vertical and horizontal growth. And most of my research is concentrated on desert regions, with emphasis on looking for groundwater resources, because the places are dry, and therefore you need a great deal of water, and therefore you would need to look for sources of water. In these places, we find that groundwater has a great deal of potential for the growth of urban populations. And when you look at this kind of setting, I will take an example of Egypt, since I know it that well, and we'll look a little bit about the big cities, starting with Cairo. And I will also cover another example of similar situation in the West Bank in Palestine. The reason for this is the fact that if you look at it from the physical environment point of view, you surmise that there is absolutely no way to keep these places growing either horizontally or vertically where they are. So you really have to find alternative places for them. It is no longer possible to think about these places as growth centers. You must begin to think about where do we do the growth from today on. So now when we look at the challenges of urban communities, there are six things, basically: the water, the food, the energy, and the sewage removal and its treatment, and the transportation and the environmental health. All of these are common to all cities, and in most of the developing world, they are compounded by the larger numbers all the time. And the governments in most of these countries just kind of try to run after each one of these issues, trying to solve them piecemeal, one at a time, and that limits the potential for drastic solutions. So in real terms, what we require here are innovative ideas, something that is beyond what is being done today. In 1990, I was visiting the Minister of Agriculture, who was a friend of mine, the Minister of Agriculture in Egypt, but who is the one that provides food. And he told me that, can you believe it? I just sent three requests, and they sent the same letter to three different agencies, asking them one very specific question. How large is the area under agricultural production in Egypt? Meaning, what is the size of the fertile land in Egypt, which we use for agriculture, including the Nile Delta and the Nile River? He said, two of these institutions are part of my ministry, and one from outside, some other ministry. So I sent these questions out just to see whether they're mixed up in the statistics. And I get three different numbers. Can you believe that the difference between these numbers is from 7.2 million acres to 5.5 million acres? And these are official government numbers, for the minister himself. So I said, how am I going to plan? What do I know? How many acres of land are under population? So these statistics can be very questionable, and if you cannot control the statistics, you cannot do much about that. And he asked me, are there ways to do this from satellite images? I said, sure. I mean, you can see exactly how large an area is in agriculture, whatever. So I got the pictures of Egypt taken in 1990, and we have pictures taken of the world since 1972 by satellite called Landsat, and we compared the two. And there is a very simple mechanism in the computers. We'll take a picture taken at time one and take a picture of the same place taken at time two, and you get the difference between them, and you get actually the change. So I provided this scene here whereby the red is old agricultural land or land under agriculture in 1972. The blue, these segments right here, is the growth till 1990, meaning in 18 years. And then, but you can see on the yellow in here, is the urban growth around the cities. And in this particular case, we showed that Cairo has grown by all the pinkish colors that you have seen right there only in 18 years, between 1972 and 1990. All of this color right here is the growth of urban community around Cairo and Giza. And you can see how much land was taken from the agriculturally productive land right here. And this happens, the halo right there around Cairo happens around all of the other cities up north, which means that if you leave this unchecked, very soon you will have no land to produce food. So this becomes a very major problem right there. So begin to look at Egypt and see what is it that is there that is that can provide some other options. And what I'm proposing right here is a road, a corridor, parallel to the Nile River, 1,200 kilometers long, with 12 connectors to the main population cities for the potential growth of urban areas around here. And topographically speaking, this is doable. In the in this corridor itself, you have the road itself, a high-speed train, a water pipeline, an electricity line, meaning all of the basics of an infrastructure that you require to build new towns. And you can have that is the highway, this is one of the 12 east-west connectors with the railroad, the water line, and the electricity line all along. The connectors themselves, they are something that up to 800 kilometers long. You can have potential for urban growth away from the Nile Valley. You can have industrial growth, you can tourism, and you can have all kinds of things to do that, provided that there is the east-west connector, and you have zones to make certain that growth around these places is somewhat regulated, but done well. You begin to think about a potential of bringing in or opening up land for urban growth, cities, towns, and then all the kinds of things that the government will do, like houses and hospitals and schools and things like that, away from the urban centers of growth. So you can bring in this growth of the centers away from where it is today. Very much with the same kind of notion, but having nothing to do with each other. There is a proposal right now on the books about the potential of how do you build Palestine, that is a state that's viable, that lives, because you know that the region of Gaza is one of the most highly populated places on earth, and it is a terrible condition for anybody to live, and that's why you have all these kinds of problems there. But if you have a way of connecting the main cities within the West Bank and link them somehow to Gaza, then the people can be moving right here. And if there were towns on either side of this corridor, then you can have a vision for potential growth, especially when you know where the places that are viable for agriculture. If you don't connect the cities themselves, stay away from the cities and make a line that goes close enough to the cities, this means that these places would be the growth places, the lines that connect between the city and the main development corridor itself. So you'd have some east-west connectors, very much like this, the notion of what I was proposing for Egypt as a whole. In general, when we think about the urban problems and you think about their physical plant, you realize that you really cannot fix the cities within the confines of the physical plant that they have today, and therefore you'd have to think out of the box. Out of the box in this case meaning that you have to find an alternative physical location for that growth as whenever possible. I maintain that in many countries in the North Africa and the Middle East, and maybe even in the Sahel region and sub-Saharan Africa, there would be places where you can think that provided that the topography allows it, you can think of allowing potential growth away from the population centers today, because this is where you can begin anew, and this is where you can organize things a little easier, provide the services a little more, and assure the sustainability of the place. So at least here are two cases of thinking out of the box in terms of how do we fix the urban problems, and if we cannot arrest the urban problems today, what is it that we're going to do tomorrow? And this solution here says, for tomorrow, you need to shift the potential growth of these of the towns and the cities away from the physical plant of the day, and nature allows it. Thank you.
Okay, first, thank you very much for the kind invitation to speak here. It's indeed a pleasure to have an opportunity to engage with such a diverse and interesting group of people. And what I would like to focus on is basically picking up with a bit with what Mark had to say, and still more with Farouk's point, particularly about urban areas as dynamic organisms, and not to simply speak of the city with any notion that we're talking about a static entity, but something that is quite organic, changing over time. And I'd like to talk in an integrated way about the change in urban habitats and how it's linked to changing health circumstances and basically the demands that are placed on not just the people in the area, but even but the full organizational structure and the management that's required if you are going to deal with the health issues of urban areas of the future. To my mind, particularly in much of the developing world, this will require a much closer linkage between what's usually thought of as the health sector, the agriculture sector, urban planning, and also the Minister of Finance. But at least the integration of health, agriculture, and urban development is something that I think deserves a lot of attention in an integrated way, and that's what I want to focus on. Rather than talking in general terms, I want to focus on two specific urban areas. One will be Dar es Salaam in Tanzania, and the other will be the growth of a vast array of new cities that are developing in the Amazon region of Brazil. That's an area that is usually thought of very much in rural terms, and I think that that's actually quite a misnomer in terms of what actually goes on. So part of what I would like to convince you of is that what we're seeing on the Amazon frontier is really the evolution of a vast urban network which has interesting problems of its own sort, but which also require this linkage between health, agriculture, and urban planning. So to begin in the African setting, I want to carry malaria along as a health problem to focus the discussion, but let me say in advance that I don't believe that dealing with a disease at a time is necessarily, in fact, by any means, the way to be dealing with health issues, but one ought to take a much more systemic approach and ask, what are the health problems of a given area and even areas within cities? But malaria is useful as a way to think about, if you like, the changing demands on the health system as a city grows. It's useful to talk about urban malaria since this is something that tends, I think, in most of the public discourse to be thought of as a problem primarily of rural poverty. However, what I find of interest is that in the case of Dar es Salaam, and incidentally this is not unique, you have a systematic attempt at malaria control which runs for over 100 years. Another place where this is the case is in the is in Malaysia when it was operating under the Federated Malay States. And indeed, one of the earliest successful malaria control programs was at Klang in Port Swettenham, facilitated by the attempt to develop the rubber industry. in the Malay states and run successfully under Malcolm Watson in the British colonial system from 1901 well into the 1920s. And at the very beginning, it was urban malaria control, which in fact led a lot of the rural activity. In the case of Dar es Salaam, initially in the German colonial period, you had a multiple intervention set up with drainage, soil modification, distribution of bed nets, some house screening, and the main theme was you had multiple interventions, many of which seem to be far below the malaria discourse of the current time, particularly those to do with environmental management. But that tends to be something that is particularly useful to think about, activate, and implement in urban settings. This was done successfully through the German colonial period. At the beginning of the British colonial period, you then had continued drainage works, stronger legal measures about the nature of agriculture in the city. The sanitation branch, was established with the East Africa Malaria Unit. This is in 1921. The Tanganyika Malaria Service established in 1951. As you go to the post-colonial period, you have mosquito control integrated into the general health services of the city. This is run with more or less success, often depending upon the financing that's been associated with it. There's a program that was part of a bilateral agreement between Tanzania and Japan that ran from 1988 through 96 with a quite interesting malaria control initiative. Some of that is being reinstalled, in fact, at the present time. The Dar es Salaam Urban Health Project, which began in 1989, ran through 2003, targeted at really developing a health infrastructure in terms of health services for the city as part of a bilateral agreement between Switzerland and Tanzania, taking a quite systemic approach to health services. And malaria, of course, was a part of this. But the main point of all of this is to indicate that this is being done in a very dynamic setting where what you call the city boundaries is, of course, changing virtually every day. And that's something that persists to the present. So in terms of planning for the future, one really needs to think about that sort of structure. Let me shift now to the Amazon frontier. And one needs to discuss this a bit in terms of where, if you like, the beginnings were of the vast opening of the Amazon for settlement, exploitation in many instances, and this begins back in the 1960s with road building as usual, and the Belém-Brasília Highway, the Trans-Amazon Highway, the Cuiabá-Porto Velho Highway, and the Cuiabá-Santarém Highway were the main, if you like, points or roads of entry into vast areas of primary forest. It was carried out by a desire for mining activities, timber extraction, rubber production, and government-sponsored agricultural colonization projects. So all of these going on simultaneously. The state of Rondônia, which I will focus on here, is just one area that was open for settlement running back into the 1970s and 80s, often viewed as kind of the new El Dorado, or where sources of potential improvement in living standards, even for relatively poor people who were in many instances given land free of charge, but there was a lot of trouble associated with that, which we will discuss in just a few minutes. The key point is there was mass migration. If you're going to talk about areas where agriculture is going to be carried out, then there's the question of soil quality and the ability to farm it effectively. There were many agricultural failures there due to a lack of adequate agricultural extension service being put in place. There's a lot of violent conflict. There was in the past, there still is, often between indigenous people of the Amazon, cattle ranchers, the timber industry. There's major deforestation. So to put it mildly, the international environmental and biodiversity lobby has been very active in trying to, if you like, slow the pace of deforestation down. But nevertheless, all of this is going on. So here's the beginning stage. It's a road that comes through vast areas of primary forest in the Amazon. And one needs to discuss the nature of what happens at the road in terms of malaria risk, if we're going to talk about that for the moment. Anopheles darlingi, the main vector responsible for malaria transmission in the Amazon, has larval habitats characterized by partial shade at the forest fringe in water of relatively high pH relative to the more acidic Amazon streams. And partial shade at the forest fringe. As soon as you put in a road, of course, you've changed the definition of forest fringe. These are not anopheles that tend to have much activity in dense, relatively dark areas in the forest, but it's at the boundaries where the action goes. So from forest to the city is something that occurs fairly rapidly. And I want to focus for a few moments on just one large government-sponsored settlement project. This is the Machadim Settlement Project in the state of Rondônia. In advance of any settlers brought into this area, plots, roughly 30 hectares apiece, were laid out, and this is land to be given away, in effect, free of charge to people encouraged to migrate from large cities in the northeast of Brazil with the opportunity of having land of their own and hopefully to engage in productive agriculture. Let me just say something about who settles on what plot and the need for this kind of collaboration between the agriculture sector, the planning, and the health. Prior to the opening of this area for settlement, soil samples were taken through this entire area. And it wasn't only the soil assessments, but each of these plots was scored in terms of agricultural potential with an indication of the kind of knowledge that was required and the kind of, if you like, capital equipment anyone would need to bring in if they were going to farm it effectively. Something that could have been done would have been the allocation of these plots matched to the capabilities of the people that came in to settle. If that had been done, you could have vastly changed the nature of the whole malaria situation here, because rapid clearance of land and, if you like, pushing the forest fringe away from where not only the housing is but the agricultural activity goes on could have had a major difference in who's at risk. None of that went on. So it's a lack of the organizational structure that's part of the problem. On a somewhat larger scale is the entire state of Rondônia. And beginning in 1975, you have a heavily forested area with only a few, if you like, colonization projects beginning, all of which are leading to this urban development in, at an enormous rate, one in which it's this mix of agriculture, urban planning, and health that's really needed if you're going to do anything in terms of protection of the local population. This is something as a process that flies totally in the face of what the international biodiversity lobby likes. In fact, there's a tension here that has never been, at least to my mind, adequately discussed or even resolved, which goes this way. If you take as a position, which I think we have to, because stopping this kind of advance into the Amazon frontier is something that many people talk about, but it hasn't been successful. If once it starts to go on, in terms of, if you like, protection of the people against malaria transmission, the best thing you can do is basically strip clear large tracts of land that are going to be used for agriculture, for mining, whatever they are. It's not to preserve the forest. In fact, where you have slow clearance of forest, those are the highest risk areas. I don't have a clear resolution to this kind of tension, but I think it's something that certainly deserves some discussion. And it's part of something that would be associated with prevention activities. Thanks very much.
If I could ask our three discussants to come up to the front, Cutler Cleveland, Tom Coons, and Florence Bynum-Ghana, and I'd like to very briefly just introduce them before they have an opportunity to make their remarks. Florence has a particular perspective because she has, I think, been one of the leading voices in the world trying to remind us that there is another global pandemic out there, one that doesn't get near the attention of HIV/AIDS or the malaria pandemic or the child survival diseases, because Florence has been an advocate for the importance of understanding mental health as truly a global pandemic. And I'll be curious whether her remarks on the emergence of even more urbanization in cities deals with some of the mental health issues. She is was the sole, and I think this is one of the important points, the sole mental health specialist at the World Bank. So I think we'll get a chance to hear your comments first. And I'd like to shift it over to two people with quite different sort of training or perspectives. Cutler Cleveland is the director of the Center for Energy and Environmental Studies and a professor of geography here at Boston University. And Cutler, interesting guy, is trying to do some of this interdisciplinary stuff, looking at the ecologic impacts, but having an economic perspective on it and a real development perspective. And in our desire to link health and development, it's people like Cutler that we turn to from some of the natural sciences to help us in thinking through some of these dynamics as the health community reaches out to others. And I want to particularly thank Professor Tom Koons, who's the professor of biology and the director of the Center for Ecologic and Conservation Biology, and has been looking at the interaction of the natural environment and human disease vectors, and will be our third discussant. Florence.
Thank you very much. In moving forward, you can see I have a whole pack of cards here. These are all my thoughts that came up because when I saw the very distinguished speakers whom I was going to be discussant for, I went and looked up their publications and had a quick read, educated myself, and so many thoughts came in. And, of course, as they spoke, I added a few more. So what I'll probably do is rush through my cards because I really think it's important to go through them. But in a summary, if I'm not able to get through my cards, I think what my message is going to be is to bring the human element in the doom and gloom picture that we've had so far. I think what the three discussants talked about is that if nothing is done, 50 years from today, the world is not going to be a very happy place. And I'm bringing in the people within that picture that was drawn much earlier. If we look at the population today as it stands, we have the biggest cohort of youth. These are people aged 15 to 24 years. If we add 50 years onto that, we are going to have the biggest cohort of the elderly. And as we heard in the opening session, this biggest cohort of the elderly is also going to be one of the most uneducated, with the lowest human capital, I think, that we've seen so far, unless we do something about it. And also because of what is going on with this biggest cohort of the youth, we are likely to have another cohort of youth just as big or maybe even bigger, mainly because we are not doing much if we are not able to control their reproduction right now. So we shall have a big cohort of the elderly and a big cohort of the youth. And so my few comments will focus on that. I'd just like to make one comment, though, that it's going to be, my comments are more also looking into longevity versus quality of life. The discussions that have gone on have focused very much on longevity. Are we thinking about longevity in and of itself, or what the quality of life is going to be for the elderly or for the youth or for whoever happens to be on this planet 50 years from today? I'm also taking my comments in the context of the whole world, the global perspective, rather than the developing world alone or the middle-income, low-income countries, because I think as we heard, are getting more and more globalized. We're getting more and more urbanized as we had, and therefore the divisions between the low and middle income, I think, are going to become much more definite. In relation to, I'll start off with the elderly and then get into the youth, and then hopefully I'll talk a little bit about habitat and environment as well. So here I go. With the elderly, I think one of the things that comes up with the elderly is the issue of family support. And if we are going to have more and more people living in the urban and peri-urban areas, there's going to be less family support for this big cohort of the elderly. And we know that with less family support, there's evidence to show that their psychological well-being is going to be poor. And this reflects their quality of life. There's going to be a high incidence of depression. I'm not going to go into that. But with the high incidence of depression that is going to be found, there's also going to be decreased cognitive function. And this is, of course, of concern, because if we have decreased cognitive function with decreased social support, and yet we haven't thought through what happens with the welfare support, what are the care systems going to be 50 years from now? We're going to have a whole group of elderly people where there's almost no support for them. There's also evidence to show that farmers and blue-collar workers, and they are likely to be the majority 50 years from now. Well, maybe not farmers, but maybe more blue-collar workers. They are more negatively associated with cognitive function. We also know that with increasing age, there's also increasing disabilities and decreasing income. And in most of the middle-income, low-income countries, we don't really have sufficient, it's almost non-existent social services for the elderly, actually non-existent. But we're going into a phase where even where they do exist, they are not going to be adequate because the cohort is going to be just too big. There's also the whole issue of violence and abuse against the elderly. It is beginning, and it is documented, but I think it's going to go up as the pressures increase on the more nuclear families that will have to care for them. We also heard about the slums. Most of the populations are going to be in slums, inner cities, shanty towns, and this too limits the kind of support that is going to be given. Because within the village communities, as we know them today, there's support from the neighbors and from the broader community, but this may not be the case as we move into increased urbanization. Also, if we take the HIV/AIDS epidemic today and the conflicts that we have the biggest cohort of orphans and vulnerable children. 50 years from today, we are going to have adults and elderly people where there has been a generation gap in their upbringing, and this is going to lead to a breakdown in the social values, the moral values of this cohort. And it does not look very good for the future. Moving on to the youth, we have the biggest cohort of orphans and vulnerable children right now. Most of them have been, a good number, like in Sierra Leone, have been referred to as the lost generation. They are the same people who are being recruited into rebel forces, and very many of them are living on the streets. And unless something is done about this cohort, we can see that this could continue to be the case. The conflicts and the violence may continue on 50 years from today. And again, in the context of AIDS, I talked about the generation gap. The parents are dead. There's the gap in the transfer of norms and values. So this, again, impacts on the youth that are going to be youth 50 years from today. There's also the issue of problem behavior, which has a negative association to contraceptive use. Within the inner cities, I think I've jumped one of my cards, but within the inner cities, the slums and the shanty towns, That is where the youth are more likely to have problem behaviors, and those youth who have problem behaviors are the ones least likely to use contraception. So we therefore have a situation where we have more youth engaging in early sexual activity and yet not using contraception. So that leads to that vicious cycle. We shall also have, right now we have a lot of child-headed households. Many of them drop out of school. They're also vulnerable to abuse, and they're the ones who end up living on the street. With the teenage pregnancies that I touched on a little earlier, they are more likely to give birth to children who have a lower birth weight, which is associated with developmental problems. Teenage mothers are unlikely to vaccinate their children. They are more likely to wean them very early, which leads to poor human capital in their children. And this again goes back to get 50 years or 20 or 30 years from today, having a whole cohort of that cycle of poverty repeating itself. Moving on to habitat now, we heard about inner cities and slums and shanty towns going to grow. There's often crowding there, which can produce stress. Studies have found higher levels of depression among women who live in the housing projects within the inner cities of today. So if this continues on 50 years from today, we can see that multiplying even more. We also heard a little bit about the neighborhood economic effects. Slums and inner cities are associated with mental disorders among the children. So this is a neighborhood economic effect that we also need to take into account. One of the slides showed what the effect is of whether you are non-poor but living within a poor environment, but this also translates to the mental health effects in the children. A neighborhood also with a higher concentration of idle youth has increased odds of sexual initiation and likelihood of not having used contraception. I talked about that one a little bit. Poor living conditions lead to increased infant and child mortality, and if people are living in slums, inner cities, in shanty towns, there's increased infant mortality. Even if services may be available in the cities, health services, we heard that very often they are not accessed for various reasons.